Chapter 4. The General Strike. How the Civil War meant emancipation, and how the black worker won the war by a general strike which transferred his labor from the Confederate planter to the Northern invader, in whose army lines workers began to be organized as a new labor force. When Edwin Ruffin, white-haired and mad, fired the first gun at Fort Sumter, he freed the slaves. It was the last thing he meant to do, but that was because he was so typically a Southern oligarch. He did not know the real world about him. He was provincial and lived apart on his plantation with his servants, his books, and his thoughts. Outside of agriculture, he jumped at conclusions instead of testing them by careful research. He knew, for instance, that the North would not fight. He knew that Negroes would never revolt. And so war came. War is murder, force, anarchy, and debt. Its end is evil, despite all incidental good. Neither North nor South had before 1861 the slightest intention of going to war. The thought was in many respects ridiculous. They were not prepared for war. The National Army was small, poorly equipped, and without experience. There was no file from which someone might draw plans of subjugation. When Northern armies entered the South, they became armies of emancipation. It was the last thing they planned to be. The North did not propose to attack property. It did not propose to free slaves. This was to be a white man's war to preserve the Union, and the Union must be preserved. Nothing that concerned the amelioration of the Negro touched the heart of the mass of Americans, nor could the common run of men realize the political and economic cost of Negro slavery. When, therefore, the Southern radicals, backed by political oligarchy and economic dictatorship in the most extreme form in which the world had seen it for 500 years, precipitated secession, that part of the North that opposed the plan had to hunt for a rallying slogan to unite the majority of the North and in the West, and, if possible, bring the border states into an opposing phalanx. Freedom for slaves furnished no such slogan. Not one-tenth of the Northern white population would have fought for any such purpose. Free soil was a much stronger motive, but it had no cogency in this contest because the free soilers did not dream of asking free soil in the South, since that involved the competition of slaves, or what seemed worse than that, of free Negroes. On the other hand, the tremendous economic ideal of keeping this great market for goods, the United States, together with all its possibilities of agriculture, manufacture, trade, and profit, appealed to both the West and the North. And what was then much more significant, it appealed to the border states. To the flag we are pledged, all its foes we abhor, and we ain't for the nigger, but we are for the war. The border states wanted the cotton belt in the Union so that they could sell it their surplus slaves. But they also wanted to be in the same union with the North and West, where the profit of trade was large and increasing. The duty, then, of saving the Union became the great rallying cry of a war which for a long time made the border states hesitate and confine secession to the far South. And yet they all knew that the only thing that really threatened the Union was slavery, and the only remedy was abolition. If, now, the far South had had trained and astute leadership, a compromise could have been made, which, so far as slavery was concerned, would have held the abnormal political power of the South intact, made the slave system impregnable for generations, and even given slavery practical rights throughout the nation. Both North and South ignored, in differing degrees, the interests of the laboring classes. The North expected patriotism and union to make white labor fight. The South expected all white men to defend the slaveholders' property. Both North and South expected, at most, a sharp, quick fight and victory. More probably, the South expected to secede peaceably and then, outside the Union, to impose terms which would include national recognition of slavery, new slave territory, and new cheap slaves. The North expected that after a threat and demonstration to appease its honor, the South would return with the right of slave property recognized and protected, but geographically limited. Both sections ignored the Negro. To the northern masses, the Negro was a curiosity, a subhuman minstrel, willingly and naturally a slave, and treated as well as he deserved to be. He had not sense enough to revolt and help northern armies, even if northern armies were trying to emancipate him, which they were not. The North shrank at the very thought of encouraging servile insurrection against the whites. Above all, it did not propose to interfere with property. Negroes, on the whole, were considered cowards and inferior beings whose very presence in America was unfortunate. The abolitionists, it was true, expected action on the part of the Negro, but how much they could not say. Only John Brown knew just how revolt had come and would come, and he was dead. Thus, the Negro himself was not seriously considered by the majority of men, North or South. And yet from the very beginning, the Negro occupied the center of the stage because the very simple physical reasons. The war was in the South, and in the South were 3,953,740 black slaves and 261,918 free Negroes. What was to be the relation of this mass of workers to the war? What did the war mean to the Negroes, and what did the Negroes mean to the war? There were two theories, both rather over-elaborated. The one that the Negro did nothing but faithfully serve his master until emancipation was thrust upon him. The other, that the Negro immediately, just as quickly as the presence of Northern soldiers made it possible, left serfdom and took his stand with the Army of Freedom. It must be borne in mind that 9/10 of the 4 million black slaves could neither read nor write, and that the overwhelming majority of them were isolated on country plantations. Any mass movement under such circumstances must materialize slowly and painfully. What the Negro did was to wait, look, and listen, and try to see where his interests lay. There was no use in seeking refuge in an army which was not an army of freedom, and there was no sense in revolting against armed masters who were conquering the world. As soon, however, as it became clear that the Union armies would not or could not return fugitive slaves, and that the masters, with all their fume and fury, were uncertain of victory, the slave entered upon a general strike against slavery by the same methods that he had used during the period of the fugitive slave. He ran away to the first place of safety and offered his services to the Federal Army. So that in this way, it was really true that he served his former master and served the emancipating army. And it was also true that this withdrawal and bestowal of his labor decided the war. The South counted on Negroes as laborers to raise food and money crops, for civilians and for the army, and even in a crisis to be used for military purposes. Slave revolt was an ever-present risk, but there was no reason to think that a short war with the North would greatly increase this danger. Publicly, the South repudiated the thought of its slaves even wanting to be rescued. The New Orleans Crescent showed the absurdity of the assertion of a general stampede of our Negroes. The London Dispatch was convinced that Negroes did not want to be free. As for the slaves themselves, crushed with the wrongs of Dred Scott and Uncle Tom, most provoking, they cannot be brought to burn with revenge. They are spies for their masters. They obstinately refuse to run away to liberty, outrage, and starvation. They work in the fields as usual when the planter and overseer are away, and only the white women are left at home. Early in the war, the South had made careful calculation of the military value of slaves. The Alabama Advertiser in 1861 discussed the slaves as a military element in the South. It said that the total white population of the 11 states now comprising the Confederacy is 5 million, and therefore, to fill up the ranks of the proposed army, 600,000, about 10% of the entire white population, will be required. In any other country than our own, such a draft could not be met. But the southern states can furnish that number of men and still not leave the material interest of the country in a suffering condition. The editor, with fatuous faith, did not for a moment contemplate any mass movement against this program on the part of the slaves. Those who are incapacitated for bearing arms can oversee the plantations, and the Negroes can go on undisturbed in their usual labors. In the North, the case is different. The men who join the army of subjugation are the laborers, the producers, and the factory operatives. Nearly every man from that section, especially those from the rural districts, leaves some branch of industry to suffer during his absence. The institution of slavery in the South alone enables her to place in the field a force much larger in proportion to her white population than the North, or indeed any country which is dependent entirely on free labor. The institution is a tower of strength to the South, particularly at the present crisis, and our enemies will be likely to find that the moral cancer, about which their orators are so fond of prating, is really one of the most effective weapons employed against the Union by the South. Soon, the South of necessity was moving out beyond this plan. It was no longer simply a question of using the Negroes at home on the plantation to raise food. They could be of even more immediate use, as military labor, to throw up breastworks, transport and prepare food, and act as servants in camp. In the Charleston Courier of November 22nd, able-bodied hands were asked to be sent by their masters to work upon the defenses. They would be fed and properly cared for. In 1862, in Charleston, after a proclamation of martial law, the governor and council authorized the procuring of Negro slaves either by the planter's consent or by impressment to work on the fortifications and defenses of Charleston Harbor. In Mississippi in 1862, permission was granted the governor to impress slaves to work in New Iberia for salt, which was becoming the Confederacy's most pressing necessity. In Texas, 1,000 Negroes were offered by planters for work on the public defenses. By 1864, the matter had passed beyond the demand for slaves as military laborers and had come to the place where the South was seriously considering and openly demanding the use of Negroes as soldiers. Distinctly and inevitably, the rigor of the slave system in the South softened as war proceeded. Slavery showed in many, if not all, respects its best side. The harshness and the cruelty, in part, had to disappear, since there were left on the plantations mainly women and children, with only a few men, and there was a certain feeling and apprehension in the air on the part of the whites, which led them to capitalize all the friendship and kindness which had existed between them and the slaves. No race could have responded to this so quickly and thoroughly as the Negroes. They felt pity and responsibility, and also a certain new undercurrent of independence. Negroes were still being sold rather ostentatiously in Charleston and New Orleans, but the long lines of Virginian Negroes were not marching to the Southwest. In a certain sense, after the first few months, everybody knew that slavery was done with, that no matter who won, the condition of the slave could never be the same after this disaster of war. And it was perhaps these considerations, more than anything else, that held the poised arm of the black man. For no one knew better than the South what a Negro crazed with cruelty and oppression and beaten back to the last stand could do to his oppressor. The Southerners, therefore, were careful. Those who had been kind to their slaves assured them of the bad character of the Yankee and of their own good intentions. Thus, while the Negroes knew there were abolitionists in the North, they did not know their growth, their power, or their intentions, but they did hear on every side that the South was overwhelmingly victorious on the battlefield. On the other hand, some of the Negroes sensed what was beginning to happen. The Negroes of the cities, the Negroes who were being hired out, the Negroes of intelligence who could read and write, all began carefully to watch the unfolding of the situation. At the first gun of Sumter, the black mass began not to move, but to heave with a nervous tension and watchful waiting. Even before war was declared, a movement began across the border. Just before the war, large numbers of fugitive slaves and free Negroes rushed into the North. It was estimated that 2,000 left North Carolina alone because of rumors of war. When W.T. Sherman occupied Port Royal in October 1861, he had no idea that he was beginning emancipation at one of its strategic points. On the contrary, he was very polite and said that he had no idea of interfering with slaves. In the same way, Major General Dix, on seizing two counties of Virginia, was careful to order that slavery was not to be interfered with or slaves to be received into the line. Burnside went further and as he brought his Rhode Island regiment through Baltimore in June, he courteously returned two Negroes who tried to run away with him. They were supposed to be slaves, although they may have been free Negroes. On the 4th of July, Colonel Pryor of Ohio delivered an address to the people of Virginia in which he repudiated the accusation that the Northern Army were abolitionists. I desire to assure you that the relation of master and servant, as recognized in your state, shall be respected. Your authority over that species of property shall not in the least be interfered with. To this end, I assure you that those under my command have peremptory orders to take up and hold any Negroes found running about the camp without passes from their masters. Halleck, in Missouri, in 1862, refused to let fugitive slaves enter his lines. Burnside, Buell, Hooker, Thomas Williams, and McClellan himself all warned their soldiers against receiving slaves, and most of them permitted masters to come and remove slaves found within the lines. The constant charge of Southern newspapers, Southern politicians, and their Northern sympathizers that the war was an abolition war met with constant and indignant denial. Loyal newspapers, orators, and preachers, with few exceptions, while advocating stringent measures for putting down the rebellion, carefully disclaimed any intention of disturbing the peculiar institution of the South. The Secretary of State informed foreign governments through our ministers abroad that this was not our purpose. President Lincoln, in all his earlier messages, substantially reiterated the statement. Leading generals, on entering Southern territory, issued proclamations to the same effect. One even promised to put down any slave insurrection with an iron hand, while others took vigorous measures to send back the fugitives who sought refuge within their lines. In the early years of the war, if accounts do not err, during the entire period, McClellan commanded the Army of the Potomac. John Brown's body was a forbidden heir among the regimental bands. The Hutchinsons were driven from Union camps for singing abolition songs, and in so far as the Northern Army interested itself at all in the slavery question, it was by the use of force to return to their Southern masters fugitives seeking shelter in the Union lines. While the information they possessed, especially respecting the roads and means of communication, should have been of inestimable service to the Federals, they were not to be employed as laborers or armed as soldiers. The North avoided the appearance of a desire to raise the Negroes from the plane of chattels to the rank of human beings. Here was no bid for the cooperation of either slaves or free Negroes. In the North, Negroes were not allowed to enlist and often refused with indignation. Thus, the weakness of the South temporarily became her strength. Her servile population, repulsed by Northern pro-slavery sentiment, remained at home, engaged in agriculture, thus releasing her entire white population for active service in the field. While, on the other hand, the military resources of the North were necessarily diminished by the demands of labor. It was, as Frederick Douglass said in Boston in 1865, that the Civil War was begun in the interests of slavery on both sides. The South was fighting to take slavery out of the Union, and the North fighting to keep it in the Union. The South fighting to get it beyond the limits of the United States Constitution, and the North fighting for the old guarantees, both despising the Negro, both insulting the Negro. It was therefore at first by no means clear to most of the 4 million Negroes in slavery what this war might mean to them. They crouched consciously and moved silently, listening, hoping, and hesitating. The watchfulness of the South was redoubled. They spread propaganda. The Yankees were not only not thinking of setting them free, but if they did anything, they would sell them into worse slavery in the West Indies. They would drive them from even the scant comfort of the plantations into the highways and purlieus. Moreover, if they tried to emancipate the slaves, they would fail because they could not do this without conquest of the South. The South was unconquerable. The South was not slow to spread propaganda and point to the wretched condition of fugitive Negroes in order to keep the loyalty of its indispensable labor force. The Charleston Daily Courier said February 18, 1863, "A company of volunteers having left Fayette County For the field of action, Mr. Nance sent two Negro boys along to aid the company. Their imaginations became dazzled with the visions of Elysian fields in Yankeedom, and they went to find them. But paradise was nowhere there, and they again sighed for home. The Yanks, however, detained them and cut off their ears close to their heads. These Negroes finally made their escape and are now at home with Mr. Nance in Pickens. They are violent haters of Yankees, and their adventures and experiences are a terror to Negroes of the region, who learned a lesson from their brethren whose ears are left in Lincolndom. The Charleston Mercury, May 8, 1862, said, "The Yankees are fortifying Fernandina, Florida, and have a large number of Negroes engaged on their works. Whenever the Negroes have an opportunity, they escape from their oppressors. They report that they are worked hard, get little rest and food, and no pay." The Savannah Daily News reports in 1862 that many stolen Negroes had been recaptured. "The Yankees had married a number of the women and were taking them home with them. I have seen some who refused to go, and others who had been forced off, at other times who had returned. It was a lovely dress parade of Alphonse and Gaston, until the Negro spoiled it, and in a perfectly logical way. So long as the Union stood still and talked, the Negro kept quiet and worked. The moment the Union army moved into slave territory, the Negro joined it. Despite all argument and calculation, and in the face of refusals and commands, wherever the Union armies marched, appeared the fugitive slaves. It made no difference what the obstacles were, or the attitudes of the commanders. It was like thrusting a walking stick into an anthill," says one writer. "And yet the army chiefs at first tried to regard it as an exceptional and temporary matter, a thing which they could control, when, as a matter of fact, it was the meat and kernel of the war." Thus, as the war went on, and the invading armies came on, the way suddenly cleared for the onlooking Negro, for his spokesmen in the North, and for his silent listeners in the South. Each step thereafter came with curious, logical, and inevitable fate. First, there were the fugitive slaves. Slaves had always been running away to the North, and when the North grew hostile, on to Canada. It was the safety valve that kept down the chance of insurrection in the South to the lowest point. Suddenly now, the chance to run away not only increased, but after preliminary repulse and hesitation, there was actual encouragement. Not that the government planned or foresaw this eventuality. On the contrary, having repeatedly declared the object of the war as the preservation of the Union, and that it did not propose to fight for slaves or touch slavery, it faced a stampede of fugitive slaves. Every step the Northern armies took then meant fugitive slaves. They crossed the Potomac, and the slaves of Northern Virginia began to pour into the army and into Washington. They captured Fortress Monroe, and slaves from Virginia and even North Carolina poured into the army. They captured Port Royal, and the masters ran away, leaving droves of black fugitives in the hands of the Northern army. They moved down the Mississippi Valley, and if the slaves did not rush to the army marched to the slaves. They captured New Orleans, and captured a great black city and a state full of slaves. What was to be done? They tried to send the slaves back, and even used the soldiers for recapturing them. This was all well enough as long as the war was a dress parade. But when it became real war, and slaves were captured or received, they could be used as much-needed laborers and servants by the Northern Army. This but emphasized and made clearer a truth which ought to have been recognized from the very beginning. The Southern worker, black and white, held the key to the war. And of the two groups, the black worker raising food and raw materials held an even more strategic place than the white. This was so clear a fact that both sides should have known it. Fremont in Missouri took the logical action of freeing slaves of the army round about him by proclamation, and President Lincoln just as promptly repudiated what he had done. Even before that, General Butler in Virginia, commander of the Union forces at Fortress Monroe, met three slaves walking into his camp from the Confederate fortifications where they had been at work. Butler immediately declared these men contraband of war and put them to work in his own camp. More slaves followed, accompanied by their wives and children. The situation here was not quite so logical. Nevertheless, Butler kept the fugitives and freed them and let them do what work they could. And this action was approved by the Secretary of War. On May 26th, only 2 days after the one slave appeared before Butler, 8 Negroes appeared. On the next day, 47 of all ages and both sexes. Each day they continued to come by 20s, 30s, and 40s, until by July 30th, the number had reached 900. In a very short while, the number ran up into the thousands. The renowned fortress took the name of the Freedom Fort, to which the blacks came by means of a mysterious spiritual telegraph. In December 1861, the Secretary of the Treasury, Simon Cameron, had written, printed, and put into the mails his first report as Secretary of War without consultation with the President. Possibly he knew that his recommendations would not be approved, but he recommended the general arming of Negroes, declaring that the Federals had as clear a right to employ slaves taken from the enemy as to use captured gunpowder. This report was recalled by the President by telegraph, and the statements of the Secretary were modified. The incident aroused some unpleasantness in the Cabinet. The published report finally said, "Persons held by rebels under such laws to service as slaves may, however, be justly liberated from their constraint and made more valuable in various employments through voluntary and compensated service than if confiscated as subjects of property." Transforming itself suddenly from a problem of abandoned plantations and slaves captured while being used by the enemy for military purposes, the movement became a general strike against the slave system on the part of all who could find opportunity. The trickling streams of fugitives swelled to a flood. Once begun, the general strike of black and white went madly and relentlessly on like some great saga. Imagine, if you will, a slave population springing from antecedent barbarism, rising up and leaving its ancient bondage, forsaking its local traditions and all the associations and attractions of the old plantation life, coming garbed in rags or in silks, with feet shod or bleeding, individually or in families and larger groups, an army of slaves and fugitives pushing its way irresistibly toward an army of fighting men, perpetually on the defensive and perpetually ready to attack. The arrival among us of these hordes was like the oncoming of cities. There was no plan in this exodus, no Moses to lead it. Unlettered reason or the mere inarticulate decision of instinct brought them to us. Often the slaves met prejudices against their color more bitter than any they had left behind. But their own interests were identical, they felt, with the objects of our armies. A blind terror stung them, an equally blind hope allured them, and to us they come. Even before the close of 1862, many thousands of blacks of all ages, ragged, with no possessions except the bundles which they carried, had assembled at Norfolk, Hampton, Alexandria, and Washington. Others, landless, homeless, helpless, in families and in multitudes, including a considerable number of wretched white people, flocked north from Tennessee, Kentucky, Arkansas, and Missouri. All these were relieved in part by army rations, irregularly issued, and by volunteer societies of the North, which gained their money from churches and individuals in this country and abroad. In the spring of 1863, there were swarming crowds of Negroes and white refugees along the line of defense made between the armies of the North and South, and reaching from Maryland to Virginia, along the coast from Norfolk to New Orleans. Soldiers and missionaries told of their virtues and vices, their joy and extreme suffering. The North was moved to an extraordinary degree, and endless bodies of workers and missionaries were organized and collected funds for materials. Rude barracks were erected at different points for the temporary shelter of the freedmen, but as soon as possible, the colonies thus formed were broken up, and the people encouraged to make individual contracts for labor upon neighboring plantations. In connection with the colonies, Farms were cultivated which aided to meet the expenses. Hospitals were established at various points for the sick, of whom there were great numbers. The separation of families by the war and illegitimate birth in consequence of slavery left a great number of children practically in a state of orphanage. This was the beginning of the swarming of the slaves, of the quiet but unswerving determination of increasing numbers no longer to work on Confederate plantations, and to seek the freedom of the Northern armies. Wherever the army marched, and in spite of all obstacles, came the rising tide of slaves seeking freedom. For a long time, their treatment was left largely to the discretion of the department managers. Some welcomed them, some drove them away, some organized them for work. Gradually, the fugitives became organized and formed a great labor force for the army. Several thousand were employed as laborers, servants, and spies. A special war correspondent of the New York Tribune writes, "God bless the Negroes, say I, with earnest lips. During our entire captivity and after our escape, they were ever our firm, brave, unflinching friends. We never made an appeal to them, they did not answer. They never hesitated to do us a service at the risk even of life, and under the most trying circumstances, revealed a devotion and a spirit of self-sacrifice that was heroic. The magic word Yankee opened all their hearts and elicited the loftiest virtues. They were ignorant, oppressed, enslaved, but they always cherished a simple and a beautiful faith in the cause of the Union and its ultimate triumph, and never abandoned or turned aside from a man who sought food or shelter on his way to freedom." This whole move was not dramatic or hysterical. Rather, it was like the great unbroken swell of the ocean before it dashes on the reefs. The Negroes showed no disposition to strike the one terrible blow which brought black men freedom in Haiti, and which, in all history, has been used by all slaves and justified. There were some plans for insurrection made by Union officers. The plan is to induce the blacks to make a simultaneous movement of rising on the night of the 1st of August next over the entire states in rebellion, to arm themselves with any and every kind of weapon that may come to hand and commence operations by burning all the railroad and country bridges and tear up railroad tracks and to destroy telegraph lines, etc., and then take to the woods, swamps, or the mountains, where they may emerge as occasion may offer, for provisions and for further depredations. No blood is to be shed except in self-defense. The corn will be ripe about the 1st of August, and with this, and hogs running in the woods, and by foraging upon the plantations by night, they can subsist. This is the plan in substance, and if we can obtain a concerted movement at the time named, it will doubtless be successful. Such plans came to naught, for the simple reason that there was an easier way involving freedom with less risk. The South preened itself on the absence of slave violence. Governor Walker of Florida said in his inaugural in 1865, "Where, in all the records of the past, does history present such an instance of steadfast devotion, unwavering attachment, and constancy as was exhibited by the slaves of the South throughout the fearful contest that has just ended? The country invaded, homes desolated, the master absent in the army or forced to seek safety in flight, and leave the mistress and her helpless infants unprotected with every incitement to insubordination and instigation, to rapine and murder, no instance of insurrection, and scarcely one of voluntary desertion has been recorded." The changes upon this theme have been rung by Southern orators many times since. The statement, of course, is not quite true. Hundreds of thousands of slaves were very evidently leaving their masters' homes and plantations. They did not wreak vengeance on unprotected women. They found an easier, more effective, and more decent way to freedom. Men go wild and fight for freedom with bestial ferocity when they must, where there is no other way. But human nature does not deliberately choose blood, at least not black human nature. On the other hand, for every slave that escaped to the Union army, there were 10 left on the untouched and inaccessible plantations. Another step was logical and inevitable. The men who handled a spade for the northern armies, the men who fed them, and as spies brought in information, could also handle a gun and shoot. Without legal authority, and in spite of it, suddenly the Negro became a soldier. Later, his services as soldier were not only permitted, but were demanded to replace the tired and rebellious white men of the North. But as a soldier, the Negro must be free. The North started out with the idea of fighting the war without touching slavery. They faced the fact after severe fighting that Negroes seemed a valuable asset as laborers, and they therefore declared them contraband of war. It was but a step from that to attract and induce Negro labor to help the Northern armies. Slaves were urged and invited into the Northern armies. They became military laborers and spies. Not simply military laborers, but laborers on the plantations, where the crops went to help the Federal Army or were sold north. Thus, wherever Northern armies appeared, Negro laborers came, and the North found itself actually freeing slaves before it had the slightest intention of doing so, indeed, when it had every intention not to. The experience of the Army with the refugees and the rise of the departments of Negro affairs were a most interesting but unfortunately little studied phase of Reconstruction. Yet it contained, in a sense, the key to the understanding of the whole situation. At first, the rush of the Negroes from the plantations came as a surprise and was variously interpreted. The easiest thing to say was that Negroes were tired of work and wanted to live at the expense of the government, wanted to travel and see things and places. But in contradiction to this was the extent of the movement and the terrible suffering of the refugees. If they were seeking peace and quiet, they were much better off on the plantations than trailing in the footsteps of the army or squatting miserably in the camps. They were mistreated by the soldiers, ridiculed, driven away, and yet they came. They increased with every campaign, and as a final gesture, they marched with Sherman from Atlanta to the sea, and met the refugees and abandoned human property on the Sea Islands and the Carolina coast. This was not merely the desire to stop work. It was a strike on a wide basis against the conditions of work. It was a general strike that involved directly in the end perhaps a 500,000 people. They wanted to stop the economy of the plantation system, and to do that, they left the plantations. At first, the commanders were disposed to drive them away, or to give them quasi-freedom and let them do as they pleased with the nothing that they possessed. This did not work. Then the commanders organized relief, and afterward, work. This came to the attention of the country first in Pierce's 10,000 Clients. Pierce of Boston had worked with the refugees in Virginia under Butler, provided them with food and places to live, and given them jobs and land to cultivate. He was successful. He came from there and, in conjunction with the Treasury Department, began the work on a vaster scale at Port Royal. Here he found the key to the situation. The Negroes were willing to work, and did work, but they wanted land to work, and they wanted to see and own the results of their toil. It was here, and in the West, and the South, that a new vista opened. Here was a chance to establish an agrarian democracy in the South. Peasant holders of small properties, eager to work and raise crops, amenable to suggestion and general direction. All they needed was honesty in treatment and education. Wherever these conditions were fulfilled, the result was little less than phenomenal. This was testified to by Pierce in the Carolinas, by Butler's agents in North Carolina, by the experiment of the Sea Islands, by Grant's Department of Negro Affairs under Eaton, and by Banks' direction of Negro labor in Louisiana. It is astonishing how this army of striking labor furnished in time 200,000 federal soldiers whose evident ability to fight decided the war. General Butler went from Virginia to New Orleans to take charge of the city newly captured in April 1862. Here was a whole city half filled with blacks and mulattoes, some of them wealthy, free Negroes, and soldiers who came over from the Confederate side and joined the Federals. Perhaps the greatest and most systematic organizing of fugitives took place in New Orleans, At first, Butler had issued orders that no slaves would be received in New Orleans. Many planters were unable to make slaves work or to support them and sent them back of the federal lines, planning to reclaim them after the war was over. Butler emancipated these slaves in spite of the fact that he knew this was against Lincoln's policy. As the flood kept coming, he seized abandoned sugar plantations and began to work them with Negro labor for the benefit of the government. By permission of the War Department and under the authority of the Confiscation Act, Butler organized colonies of fugitives and regulated employment. His brother, Colonel Butler, and others worked plantations, hiring the Negro labor. The Negroes stood at Butler's right hand during the trying time of his administration, and particularly the well-to-do Free Negro Group were his strongest allies. He was entertained at their tables, and brought down on himself the wrath and contempt not simply of the South, but even of the North. He received the black regiment and kept their black officers, who never forgot him. Whatever else he might have been before the war, or proved to be afterwards, the colored people of Louisiana, under the proper sense of the good you have done to the African race in the United States, beg leave to express to you their gratitude. From 1862 to 1865, many different systems of caring for the escaped slaves and their families in this area were tried. Butler and his successor, Banks, each sought to provide for the thousands of destitute freedmen with medicine, rations, and clothing. When General Banks took command, there was suffering, disease, and death among the 150,000 Negroes. On January 30, 1863, he issued a general order making labor on public works and elsewhere compulsory for Negroes who had no means of support. Just as soon, however, as Banks tried to drive the freedmen back to the plantations and have them work under a half-military slave regime, the plan failed. It failed not because the Negroes did not want to work, but because they were striking against these particular conditions of work. When, because of wide protest, he began to look into the matter, he saw a clear way. He selected Negroes to go out and look into conditions and to report on what was needed, and they made a faithful survey. He set up a little state with its Department of Education, with its landholding and organized work, and after experiment, it ran itself. More and more, here and up the Mississippi Valley, under other commanders and agents, experiments extended and were successful. Further up the Mississippi, a different system was begun under General Grant. Grant's army in the West occupied Grand Junction, Mississippi, by November 1862. The usual irregular host of slaves then swarmed in from the surrounding country. They begged for protection against recapture, and they, of course, needed food, clothing, and shelter. They could not now be re-enslaved through army aid, yet no provision had been made by anybody for their sustenance. A few were employed as teamsters, servants, cooks, and scouts, yet it seemed as though the vast majority must be left to freeze and starve, for when the storms came with the winter months, the weather was of great severity. Grant determined that Negroes should perform many of the camp duties ordinarily done by soldiers, that they should serve as fatigue men in the departments of the Surgeon General, Quartermaster, and Commissary, and that they should help in building roads and earthworks. The women worked in the camp kitchens and as nurses in the hospitals. Grant said, "It was at this point where the first idea of the Freedmen's Bureau took its origin." Grant selected as head of his Department of Negro Affairs John Eaton, chaplain of the 27th Ohio Volunteers, who was soon promoted to the colonelcy of a colored regiment, and later, for many years, was a commissioner of the United States Bureau of Education. He was then constituted chief of Negro Affairs for the entire district under Grant's jurisdiction. "I hope I may never be called on again to witness the horrible scenes I saw in those first days of the history of the freedmen in the Mississippi Valley. Assistance were hard to get, especially the kind that would do any good in our camps. A detailed soldier in each camp of 1,000 people was the best that could be done. His duties were so onerous that he ended by doing nothing. In reviewing the condition of the people at that time, I am not surprised at the marvelous stories told by visitors who caught an occasional glimpse of the misery and wretchedness in these camps. Our efforts to do anything for these people, as they herd it together in masses, when founded on any expectation that they would help themselves, often failed. They had become so completely broken down in spirit, through suffering, that it was almost impossible to arouse them. Their condition was appalling. There were men, women, and children in every stage of disease or decrepitude, often nearly naked, with flesh torn by the terrible experiences of their escapes. Sometimes they were intelligent and eager to help themselves. Often they were bewildered, or stupid, or possessed by the wildest notions of what liberty might mean, expecting to exchange labor and obedience to the will of another for idleness and freedom from restraint. Such ignorance and perverted notions produced a veritable moral chaos. Cringing deceit, theft, licentiousness, all the vices which slavery inevitably fosters, were hideous companions of nakedness, famine, and disease. If you had profited by the misfortunes of the master, and were jubilant in their unwonted ease and luxury. But these stood in lurid contrast to the grimmer aspects of the tragedy, the women in travail, the helplessness of childhood and of old age, the horrors of sickness and of frequent death. Small wonder that men paused in bewilderment and panic for seeing the demoralization and infection of the Union soldier and the downfall of the Union cause.